Hej och välkomna alla lyssnare till Advokatsamfundspodden som den här gången kommer att hållas på engelska eftersom vi har ett unikt och exklusivt besök ifrån New York av en professor som heter Heidi Brown. Och vi är väldigt glada att hon är här och kan delta i våran podd. Och det gör också Jens Näström som är arbetspsykolog och specialiserad på advokater kan man kanske säga, som jag ska presentera närmare, verksam i Sverige. Jag vill också gärna berätta om vad vi ska prata om. Vi ska prata om intellektuell ödmjukhet och självkännedom och att skapa förutsättningar för hållbara arbetsprestationer inom advokatyrket. Det är ju ganska unikt skulle jag vilja säga, och Heidi Brown har ganska unik kompetens på det här området, så det ska bli väldigt spännande att höra henne berätta om det. Och utifrån det så I will switch into English so you also understand, Heidi, what I'm saying. And it is a great pleasure and an honor to welcome you here to the Swedish Bar Association and to our podcast. And you are a law professor in New York. And also an associate dean for upper level legal writing in New York Law School. That's correct.
Yes, it is. Yeah. Thank you.
And you have also written many books. So you're the author of books as The Flourishing Lawyer, Untangling Fear in Lawyering, and The Introverted Lawyer. And only the titles, you know, makes me very, very excited. I haven't read them yet, but it will be really exciting to talk about it. And as I said, we also have Jens Näström here. He's an occupational psychologist, and you are specialized in lawyers. And since many years, 20 years
back. That's correct.
Yeah, great. So you're very welcome also, and I'm happy to give you my warmest welcome.
Thank you.
So I think in the beginning we need a background. So maybe it's possible for you, Heidi, to tell us a little bit about your research and how did you start?
Thank you. I'm really happy to be here with both of you today. I started thinking about these topics when I was practicing law. I went to law school in the United States right out of college. So I was 21 years old when I went to law school. And I started my career as a construction litigation attorney, not really knowing what any of those words meant when I entered the profession. It was a very intense way of practicing law. I did that for 15 years, loving the research and writing aspects of my job, but the performance aspects, the negotiations, the mediations, the courtroom appearances, really the arguing, really gave me a hard time, and I didn't know why. I thought there was something wrong with me. But I felt I was cut out for the profession, but I just didn't know really where I fit. So fast forward 15 years, I started teaching legal writing at a law school in California. And what I learned over that first year of teaching legal writing was that my most creative legal writers, my smartest students in my classroom, were also the ones who were the most afraid of the performance aspects of being a law student or being a lawyer. But they were brilliant writers. They loved the research and writing like I did. So that led me to start researching the concepts of introversion and extroversion and what the differences are, and also the differences among introversion and shyness and social anxiety. I grappled with all three of those, and they're different categories. They don't all mean the same thing. So that's what got me into researching really the science behind some of those concepts and trying to figure out, first of all, how to help myself so I could be a better teacher as I transitioned into full-time teaching away from full-time practicing of law, and how I could help my students. And so that's what led me into writing the book, The Introverted Lawyer. And then I became fascinated with the science of fear. I can talk about this a little bit more later. But
the science of fear?
Yes.
In being a lawyer or what?
Yes. Yeah. For me, having all that performance anxiety through 15 years of full-time practice and really the beginning of my teaching career, my fear manifested physically in my physical body. And because I'd never talked to anyone about it, I didn't understand really the physicality of fear and what happens to us, the science of what happens to us when we are anxious or afraid to do performance activities or tasks that are required of us as lawyers. So that led me to write a book, Untangling Fear. I don't like slogans like just face your fears or do something every day that scares you. I was doing that and nothing was changing. So I wanted to instead, I like the verb untangle. So that I called that book Untangling Fear, really trying to understand what's motivating about fear, but also what can be debilitating about fear. And then that book led to the most recent one, the concept of flourishing, not just feeling good, but functioning well when we encounter those inevitable struggles that we all encounter as lawyers.
Yeah, but why is this important for lawyers? I mean, is it more important for lawyers than for other in other professions? Or
I think it's important for everybody, but I think in the legal profession, at least in my experience where I've been practicing law, we weren't talking about it enough. It was more just focused on the intellectual aspect of being a lawyer, not the physicality of performance. And I like to think of this whole approach as treating ourselves like athletes or performers, because as lawyers, we aren't just there's a great book by a woman named Caroline Williams who wrote a book called Move. And she says, we're not just a brain on legs. We are a whole body between our brain and our feet. And as lawyers, we use our whole bodies to perform. And I feel that, at least in my experience, we weren't talking about how to use all our different dimensions as lawyers. We were only talking about our brains. But there's so much more to it. There's our emotions, our feelings. And for those of us like me who struggle with the anxiety and fear aspects of it, there are things we can do with our physical bodies to be more prepared to step into performance arenas.
Mm, so interesting. And Jens, you are also specialized in lawyers, even if you're not a lawyer yourself. But tell us, how come you are interested in this area, and how do you know Heidi?
Towards the end of the psychology program, I had this sort of idea that perhaps working with clients, especially as in criminal law or family law, that you would be psychologically challenged in your interactions, and that you would be in situations that psychologists and psychiatrists train for years. You would meet people under great distress or people that have personality disorders, and you would have no training at all. So me and a fellow student wanted to explore that, and also then in a wider context, explore factors that drive well-being and performance in lawyers. And your predecessor was kind enough to allow us to do a national study. And that sort of one thing led to another. And so I'm not a lawyer. I have the outside perspective. So it's almost for me like I feel sometimes like an anthropologist studying this strange tribe of lawyers and their customs and traits and so on. So I've done that for almost 20 years, and it's just great. I love it. And sometimes you don't get to choose what you love, but this is what I love to do.
It's nice to hear, though, as a lawyer, interested in our field. Yeah.
But I couldn't agree more with Heidi when it comes to, I think, the great potential for development for lawyers lies in the fact that they are humans, and the human factor has a lot more that could be brought forth and in a much more holistic way, because when you have something that is so engaging and that involves not just your intellect, but also certainly your emotions and your body, and in terms of performance, I think that's also a very realistic, healthy approach to lawyering. So this is very interesting.
Is it that the lawyers tend to forget a little bit about everything else than the brain?
Yes, I think we become hyper-focused on the intellectual sides of our job and maybe squash our emotional sides at times, or don't tend to our physical sides at times. And again, if we use this sort of athlete or performer model, athletes and performers don't just focus on the one skill that brings them glory on the field or on the stage. They focus on multiple dimensions, and they have help. They have experts like you who help them think through performance problems. If things pop up that are new or they haven't experienced a certain scenario before, they get help. And we don't tend to stigmatize athletes and performers for seeking that kind of help. But in the legal profession, it almost is viewed as a weakness. And I think we can change that. I think we can say out loud, hey, I need some help with this to make me better at my job and to enjoy my job more.
Yeah, and I think there might be two reasons why it's kind of a taboo to seek that support and help. I think one is the narrative that is being portrayed in the professional mystique of lawyers in John Grisham novels and books and so on, that lawyers internalize as part of their professional identity. And the other part is that many lawyers are, for lack of a better term, insecure overachievers. And if you have that kind of trait, then it is a challenge for you to acknowledge that you are struggling and that there are things that you may not live up to your own high, unrealistic expectations. And so that would sort of be to admit a vulnerability or that you're not living up to your own very, very high standards.
Hmm. Heidi, you have talked also about authentic lawyering. What do you mean by that? It sounds difficult.
It is difficult because it requires some self-exploration. But when I stopped trying to pretend like I knew what I was doing, I think the mantra I was told my whole life was fake it till you make it. And I really tried doing that. I tried faking confidence when I wasn't feeling confident. But none of that ever worked for me. It was only until I stopped faking it and I got authentic with myself and discovered that the things that I bring to the table as a lawyer are different from what other individuals bring, and that's a good thing. But I had been so busy trying to pretend that I was like the lawyers on the other side of the table from me. And instead, when I got to know myself and understood I'm an introvert, I love research and writing. Okay, so when I have to step into the performance arena, I need to prepare differently than say an extrovert would. That doesn't make me better or worse at my job. It just makes me have to prepare differently. And I think that's what authentic lawyering means, giving ourselves permission to understand what makes us different and why that's an asset to the profession instead of a weakness or something that should be stigmatized. So there's kind of two steps. One is the self-discovery, giving ourselves permission to figure out what we are like and what drives us and under what environmental circumstances we do our best work. And then practicing that, like an athlete or performer, having routines and rituals so that when we do step into performance scenarios, we know we can be confident. And because we've been in those scenarios before, or we've practiced and prepared for it, and giving ourselves permission to not get it perfectly correct every time, because reality isn't perfect, it's real. And I think that's where the authenticity comes in.
But then a question, does the law firm really understand the law firms? Do they understand that? Sometimes I think a lot of lawyers, especially the younger lawyers, think that the profession demands conformity in a way. You know, you're supposed to be and act a certain way and act like everyone else. So, I mean, do really the law firms, I know you don't have experience from Swedish law firms though, but still, it must be very difficult.
That what you just described is very similar to the United States approach. And in the past, I think for decades really, there's sort of been this message that there's one, quote, one right pathway to be a quote, successful or a good lawyer. And I think
both the way you act and the way you look and the way you present and
the
you
way
should
you
do
argue.
It the way that everyone else does, and especially, you know, the older, more experienced lawyers that own the law firm, in a way.
I agree that that's what the tradition has been.
Yeah.
I do think that that's by reinforcing that into the future, we're not going to get the best performance out of all the individuals in our profession by just forcing everyone to act the same. I tried acting like the construction litigators across the table from me, and they were usually older, angrier men with loud, confident voices, but that just wasn't me. And when I finally started relying more on my writing to be my voice and to amplify my voice for me, I felt much more confident walking into a negotiation with 8 or 10 other people around the table because I had the preparation and the mode of expressing myself that felt more authentic to me. And I was able to bring people together to solve problems instead of just fighting or pounding my fist on the table like the other people tended to do. And for that, it worked for them, but that just wasn't a style that was ever going to work for me.
No.
Do you think you were experiencing imposter syndrome back then?
I think I was trying to fake a persona that didn't fit me.
Yeah.
I felt like an imposter in that I didn't know where I fit in the profession, but I knew I had some gifts that I could contribute. And I mentioned the research and writing. That always felt very comfortable for me. There's a great book by a psychologist named Dr. Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi, who wrote a book called Flow. And he describes the state of being where you're so immersed in a task that you lose all sense of time and space. And for me, legal writing was that. I could solve problems through my writing. But when I had to go into an interpersonal dynamic, I didn't know how to put myself into that state of mind where I could succeed. I do now because I understand the science of what happens to me physically when I get nervous or I feel I experience that imposter syndrome. I feel self-doubt. I feel insecure. I was an overachiever and still am, but I would get insecure. Now I have routines and rituals that I've practiced to recalibrate physically, mentally, and emotionally. So I feel like I wish I could go back and redo all those awful courtroom experiences.
But isn't it sometimes also part of being young? I know. I mean, when it comes to you get older, you get more experienced, and so it must be more difficult to try to figure out the way you yourself want to act when you're younger than when you're a bit older. Or
my parents always told me that they said, just wait till you're older, or it's age and experience that are helping you become who you are now. I actually slightly disagree, because for me, if I had kept doing the things I was doing all those years and without doing this self-discovery, without giving myself permission to be an introverted lawyer, I would not have reached this point where I get excited to do the things that 20 years ago I really didn't like doing at all. So I don't think it's just age or just experience and all of that goes away. I think for individuals who are situated like I was, I really had to do that self-discovery work. It wasn't going to come automatically because I was so busy pretending to be somebody I wasn't. So I strongly encourage the new generation of attorneys to not just feel like things will get better with more experience. I think it's much a wiser approach is to, again, give yourself permission to do a lot of this exploration that takes time. So I think a lot of the law firms might be thinking, we don't have time for that.
Exactly.
but we really do. If we want to be in this profession for decades and be healthy contributors to the profession, it's important to do that work and understand not only what strengths we bring to the profession, but how to amplify those strengths and how to cultivate cultures in our law firms that can enable everybody to really flourish.
Yeah.
I think that the whole topic is very relevant for lawyers and especially perhaps law firms, because we're talking about traits that are especially common and pronounced among lawyers, self-doubt and the overachiever and the insecure achiever trait and so on. So you have people that are often very self-critical and have very high expectations of themselves. And then they go into a profession where you have to have the highest standards. You can't really make mistakes. Everyone makes mistakes, but you're not supposed to make mistakes. So many people mature naturally through the years and become more secure, but I think we could help them by reaching them perhaps already in law school or as a junior associates or paralegals and support them into that transition to become more confident, because it's such an unnecessary source of stress, not being able to manage these super high external and internal demands. So I think there's lots to be done there.
But would you say that is one of the biggest problems for young lawyers in law firms? Trying to
it is because often you would think, okay, what are the biggest problems? It's the billable hours, it's the demanding clients or partners, but those factors are not going to change. They were there yesterday, they're not going to be there tomorrow, and they're going to be very much the same. So the one thing that you really can work on is with your own self-leadership and how to lead yourself and how to manage challenges and mistakes, that huge taboo that can be really sort of disastrous in experiencing yourself making a big mistake. And you all make that as part of the professional development. So surely I think that would be something that is the lowest hanging fruit if you want to help people in their performance, in their stress management, in what you're talking about, seeing yourself as a performer, a professional performer. You do that with athletes as well, of course. Performance management and anxiety related to that.
But according to your experience then, because you have met a lot of lawyers in Swedish law firms, how well, I mean, are the Swedish lawyers dealing with this? I mean, do they cope or how well can they cope with work-life balance, for example, or dealing with themselves? Does it work well for them?
No, it doesn't. And that's not to put down the Swedish law firms. I think law firms in general, you attract people that are super performers. So that would be overachievers. And you put them into an organization where you have essentially up or out. So you're being evaluated on your performance and you have very high standards and very low margins for mistakes. But it's also an organization that being permeated by this trait. So you have an insecure overachiever culture. And it's really hard to make the organization aware of this and to talk about it. There are ways to do it, but traditionally that's just something you hope for, having a great mentor or support partner at home or just sort of flukes of luck that would help you do that. And then you have a process in which some people are able to hang around and they can sort of transition into a more mature way of doing it. But no, I think this is a huge blind spot currently, yes.
Yeah. And what do you say, Heidi? Do you have experience in law firms trying to support the well-being of their lawyers?
Yes, there's definitely a huge well-being movement right now. But I do think that the people in charge, the law firm leaders, at least in the United States, they obviously the bottom line is important to them. The performance and servicing the client is important to them. And I think there's a tension right now between trying to figure out how to support the well-being of the younger generation of attorneys, but still serve the economics of the profession. This is why I like the athlete and performer model, though, because a lot of times some of the pushback I've gotten on my writing and my work is, oh, you're trying to reduce the rigor of the profession. And I want to say I'm not trying to do that at all. The intellectual rigor of the profession is what makes it so exciting and important. So I believe that instead, if we look to see how great coaches, great athletic coaches, get the best out of their team, it's not by telling them you're up or out necessarily. It's saying, okay, let's talk about what happens when you make a mistake in this scenario. Here's how we can remedy that. We can talk openly about mistakes to prevent future mistakes. But honor, as Jens said, mistakes happen. We hope that they're small. But in order to cultivate a culture where people aren't operating under a state of fear of making mistakes, I know the medical profession in their training has what's called in the United States, there's some schools that teach in a mistake room. So the whole point is for students to learn how to point out mistakes, even to people in positions of authority who they might be afraid to say, hey, I don't think we should do that ahead of time. So we prevent mistakes. But again, the athlete and performer model in terms of just empowering these junior attorneys to want to perform great, but also be able to acknowledge when things aren't going well and ask for help in that regard.
Isn't there a risk in all this that there are, you know, older generations thinks that the younger generations, you know, they're not as good as they are in working and, you know, delivering billable hours. And is there a risk that the generations don't understand each other when it comes to this? Because when you're talking, I mean, it's obvious that even if you're a bit older, this would be good for your well-being also. But it's more difficult, I guess, maybe if you're 60 years old than if you're 30 and have a longer career in front.
Yes.
I don't know.
I worked in three different law firms and I've worked in three different law schools. And our profession is very slow to embrace change, because it's built on tradition and precedent. And I won't say but I'll say and we need to evolve. I mean, even we were talking earlier about artificial intelligence and new technology and how law was different before we all had BlackBerries and cell phones and could access email at all hours of the night. So we have to change, and we're only going to have more disruptive change happening. And I think this is one aspect of that, that the profession is capable of change. It's just, it takes us a while sometimes to speak the same language and realize that we're all hopefully on the same page.
What do you think, Jens? Is it possible for us in Sweden to make a change?
It's tricky. It is tricky because you have that tension. I mean, first of all, I would like to say I see a lot of good intentions in law firms wanting to make improvements in this area. But there is that tension with a very successful business model with the billable hours. And so we certainly see that here as well when it comes to it. I think when we compare generations, it's a little bit of apples and oranges, because the senior generation did not have the cell phone mania that we have and the screen mania that comes with it as well. So that's something that is different. Something else that is different that I don't think has not been recognized enough is the growth of size in law firms, both in the US and in Sweden. So the largest law firm in Sweden in the 80s were maybe 30 lawyers, and now you have hundreds of them. And this means that there are new challenges in terms of leadership and management and so on, and there is no long-standing tradition for that. So I'm hoping to see that there will be a catch-up in terms of competence and ambition in managing a sizable business, and not just a small law firm with a couple of dozen of lawyers.
Is there any advice you can give to younger law students or younger lawyers, you know, to help them? Because as I understand it, it's important for them to also be able to talk about difficult things or their own, you know, personal fears or whatever it can be. How can we help them to do that? Because I guess you're quite afraid in the beginning of a career that you will ruin your career if you're taking too much space and being too much of an individual, if you understand what I mean.
I do. I think the self-discovery, though, is the key, is, again, giving ourselves permission to figure out and to assess, am I an introvert? Am I an extrovert? Under what circumstances do I do my best work? What time of day do I do my best work? I had to realize that for me, I'm much more productive when I can be independent and close my door, et cetera, and not be in the chaos of a vibrant office environment. But obviously, I don't have the luxury to do that all the time. But I had to learn that on the days that I'm going to have back-to-back-to-back meetings, those won't be the days that I get my best writing done. That's okay. But I didn't know that until I started analyzing how I function. And so I think for this new generation of lawyers, or the younger generation of lawyers, really get to know when you function at your peak, and also be able to articulate that, practice articulating that, not in a way that seems like we're asking for special treatment or again, to reduce the rigor of our jobs. Instead, the opposite, how we can show our supervisors or the people that we work for, hey, I'm going to get my best work done today, but I just need to shut my door for an hour so I can edit this really important document. I never knew how to articulate that to my bosses. I always felt like there was something wrong with me because I didn't work the same way they did. So I think enhancing our communication channels, and also for law firm leaders to be open to hearing that kind of thing, because it might not be something that they're used to hearing, but we can cultivate a culture of better communication so we can get the best out of everybody. That probably sounds very idealistic, but
no, I mean, the leaders also need to reflect upon that they need to listen and give the younger lawyers then the time to explain and really to listen to that, and not think that everyone should act at this in the same way. Or
right,
yeah.
I wanted to just point out one other athlete analogy that might be helpful in this. There are going to be times when this law firm leader, the supervisor, says no, that's not possible right now. So I like to teach this in terms of three different phases. One is, well, we may have all heard of the term grit, and grit is defined by another psychologist, Dr. Angela Duckworth, as perseverance and passion for long-term goals. But when we're being gritty, we are we have to do what's called deliberate practice. And when we do deliberate practice as we're training and we're getting better at things, the challenge before us exceeds our skill level. So that can cause this anxiety or this imposter syndrome. But the more we engage in deliberate practice, our skill level rises and we meet the challenge, and that can put us in that state of flow, which is, I think, an awesome state to be in. When we're performing great, we're in this optimal performance mode. What I want to point out, though, is that there's situations like when athletes are have a high-stakes game or something or match where we have to be clutch performers. And that's when a law firm leader can push back a little bit and say, no, you know, you have to really step up, but it's just for this precise moment. A clutch performance is, we're not in a state of flow because we can't just forget time and space exists, but we know that for this specific circumstance, a finite amount of time, we've practiced enough to invest all our energy into that peak performance in the middle of a courtroom or in some sort of big negotiation, because we know it's going to end, and then we can relax and we can take a break. So I think informing law firms and leaders, but also people who are still learning about those three phases might be helpful too, because we have to approach them all in a different mindset way.
Mm. Oh, that's really interesting. I'm asking Jens again. There's so many new, you know, thoughts and insights for me too, actually. Thinking of...
Yes, just great input from Heidi right there. So I can't really top you, so I'll take a different approach. And
to relate to the Swedish market also, I think, but yeah, maybe absolutely. It's not a big difference. I don't know, in law firms in the United States.
I think the psychological grammar is the same. Yeah. The exact levels of stress and billable hours will differ. But I think in terms of psychological grammar, lawyers from Stockholm and New York will certainly have a lot in common. There's no doubt about that. I'm thinking of relationships. And the first and most important relationship is to yourself, your own psychological drivers. Can you forgive yourself and your self-leadership? So it all starts there. And once you can lead yourself, you can also start to lead others. Having a mentor, a really good mentor, an invested mentor, not just like someone who's casually assigned to you, is very important. Having a confidant, someone in the industry that you can speak very openly with, and your true. Dirty secrets and anger can stay safe with them, just having a glass of wine and be able to pour it all out in a very unprofessional way is very helpful. And then having an old friend who you knew before you became a lawyer, who doesn't care about your work, doesn't want to hear about your work, and remind you who you were at heart before. So when you meet that person, suddenly you're sort of thrown back to high school or whenever you used to hang out. It's very important and very easy to lose connection with those people in an intense career. So be very careful and take care of those relationships. And then if you have a partner at home, sometimes you will have to act as a team, as a SWAT team, to manage everyday life. It's not just going to be 9 to 5, everything is neat and tidy. You will need to support and step up for each other. And this is especially important for female lawyers, that they have a partner at home who is committed to supporting their career, and to have that expressed and openly in your relationship. Otherwise, you will have a very sort of long uphill slope, and that will make it very tricky for you.
It's so interesting. Tomorrow you will give a lecture here at the Swedish Bar Association, and hopefully we can broadcast also the lecture on our website, so everyone that listens now and are feel, you know, really interested in these in this can look at the lecture later on our website. But is there like a final something final to summarize a little bit, advice that you can give to lawyers listening now, both students or practicing lawyers?
I will just reiterate the self-discovery part. It can maybe seem a little daunting or a little scary, but it's actually wildly fascinating to get to know ourselves and figure out how we can absolutely perform at our best and thrive and enjoy the practice of law. I joke with my legal writing students that I was mad at Socrates for 20 years for inventing the Socratic method, which is the way that legal education is normally delivered in the United States. But when I started studying Socrates, Socrates' maxim was know thyself. It was inscribed on the temple, a temple in Delphi, Greece. And I think if we can just remind ourselves that exercising intellectual humility, not pretending that we have all the answers or we have the whole profession figured out, but giving ourselves the chance to get to know ourselves, we're going to be much better at our jobs and much happier individuals.
Yeah, that's great. I love that. Knowing yourself, knowing your drivers, what your motivation, why are you doing this? And if you feel that it really sucks, why are you still there? And I think sometimes you might find the answer in your heart. And it's not just about the situation you're in. And then I think my final recommendation, best practice, would be to read Heidi's books.
Thank you.
That's a good advice. That's something I will do too.
As a legal writing professor, I love that you use the phrase psychological grammar. So I'm going to be borrowing that and giving you all the credit.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Heidi Brown and Jens Näsström, for joining our podcast today. I'm very happy and pleased that you were here. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.